papers and cell phones, and do not bring any beverages or food into the church. Refreshments must remain in the Duke Room. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Michael C. and Sue, have the lists of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Rob M. will read the preamble.
Good evening, I'm Rob, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Cindy will read the steps.
Hi, everyone. My name is Cindy, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Clovis will read the traditions.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Clovis, and I'm an alcoholic. There are the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Okay. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. And our first 10-minute speaker is John.
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
And I've never had so many people standing and staring at me ever before in my life. I feel like I'm in the Super Bowl. Boy, this is like, there's more people than there usually are here at this meeting tonight. And I want to thank Mark P. for asking me to speak. It's an honor and privilege to speak here at the Atlantic Group. Just to give you a little bit of information, I got sober November 5th, 2001. My last drink was 2 a.m. Sunday night of November 4th, and I walked 60 blocks home from downtown and pretty drunk and pretty miserable time. Just to give you a little background about this meeting, my sponsor here is Stacy, and I first started coming to this meeting, I think I had like 6 months or a year in sobriety, and I absolutely hated this meeting. I hated it so much, and the main reason why I hated this meeting is everybody was so happy. And you'd walk in the front door, and there are people, like, staring at you in your face, and they want to shake your hand. They say, hey, how are you? Nice to meet you. And I just wanted, you know, I played football when I was a kid, so I wanted to put on, like, the football helmet, put the football under my arm, and kind of, like, run through this line and hit everybody. I wasn't really sure what to do. So, you know, I'd come to this meeting, and I'd had, like, this major resentment right when I walked in the door. So I figured out I was much smarter than everyone. So I'd run right through the back, and then I'd go to, like, the men's room or something, act like I was going down there, and then come back up, and I'd sit in the back. And the speakers were so great, you know, that we attracted really, really good speakers here at the Atlantic Group. So that's the one thing that, you know, kept coming here. I had a couple buddies I got sober with. They were coming here. My sponsor eventually was here, and so I was coming on Tuesdays. And, you know, it's just become the transformation is amazing. 4.5 years ago, I would never imagine I'm standing in front of a bunch of people sober and also talking about being sober. I was born in Newport News, Virginia, and my dad was a doctor and my mother was in the fashion business. And, you know, I can remember when I was a little kid, you know, I don't know if this has to do with alcoholics. I love the smell of gasoline and I love sniffing magic markers. I just absolutely loved it. And, you know, like an early age, at like 5 and 6, you know, I hear stories like people come here and they talk about being, you know, criminals and like, you know, robberies and stuff. Try to top this. I was 5 years old and I vandalized the next door neighbor's tractor and lied about it and had just told my friend about it. And the next door neighbor came over and we just totally disassembled this guy's tractor and put it in the backyard. And like that started my career as a criminal. And I was 5 and I can remember it. And I can remember this guy asking me, you know, did I do this? And I said, no, and I made up some lie. And it was like the first of like thousands, like millions of lies that I said. So I also was just, you know, like Dennis the Menace. I was in so much trouble. My parents, I have ADD. I was really hyper. And my sister was really quiet. And I have an older sister. And she was, like, speaking it, like, in full sentences when she was, like, 15 months old. And, you know, I didn't speak till I was, like, 2 or 3. And I had, like, my own little language. And so, you know, I did a lot of bad stuff. But from early on, I was always friends with, like, the really wrong crowd. And I'm not so sure if I was really, like, the leader, but I was, like, you know, the number two guy. And so my buddy Hank, my best friend Hank, when we were little, blew up his face in a chemistry set. We'd ride our bikes around and, like, terrorize places. We made potato cannons and shoot potatoes at people. We threw smoke bombs, you know, firecrackers, you name it, you know, we did it. And my parents got divorced. I moved here to New York and grew up in this neighborhood and moved here when I was like 7 years old. And, you know, I can remember when I was like 6 years old, I think I had my first drink of alcohol before my parents got divorced. My parents would have like these dinner parties and there was this creme de menthe liqueur sitting on the coffee table. And my mom, I'd ask my mom for it and she like, let me have like a little sip. And she'd just say, just a little sip, you know, and I can remember now, it took me a couple of years in sobriety to remember, I used to sneak back into the liquor cabinet and go and, like, drink the creme de menthe liqueur. Like, I don't know if I got drunk, but, like, I drank it, and I know that. And so, you know, we talk about in sobriety, you know, alcohol is only a symptom of our disease. And I can pinpoint when I was 6 my disease. I was lying down on, like, a pillow. And, like, the pillow looked like it was enormous. It was in my dad's, like, bedroom. And my dad was still at work. My sister hadn't come back from school yet. And my mom was still working. And I was upstairs alone. And I was, like, you know, watching, like, cartoons and stuff. And I'd, like, pass out on this pillow. And I'd feel so alone. I'd feel like I was connected with, like, you know, different strokes or something. Like, it was the only, like, connection I had. And I felt so alone, so scared, and I felt like I was missing something. There was something different from me than the rest of the kids. And, you know, that feeling just gets worse and worse and worse as we get older. So I was living here in New York. I was, 13 years old and lots of trouble. You know, they wanted to kick me out of school a bunch of times. And I started, you know, my whole drinking career. And so, you know, you've heard alcoholic stories, you know, or 30-minute speaker can tell you about, you know, all these different, like, war stories and stuff. I mean, I've got tons of them. I did a lot of crazy stuff. There's so many of them, I can't even imagine, you know, going through them right now. But, you know, I remembered one incident. You know, I just remember thinking back, alcohol was my medicine. You know, when I was 13, 14, like, we started drinking. Like, we had fake IDs. And, you know, you've got to finance, you know, a drinking habit somehow. So I'd steal my mom's money or a credit card. And, you know, I'd get in trouble. She'd kick me out of the house. I'd move back into the house. And that wouldn't stop me there. You know, she'd, like, take her purse. She'd put it in her bedroom. She's remarried, living with my stepfather. So the purse is right near her bed. That didn't stop me either. So I'd crawl through the bathroom, crawl into the, you know, into their bedroom, take the American Express card, and go out to a bar. I was 15 years old, and it was packed. Like 150 15-year-old kids here in the Upper East Side. And, like, that is when, like, I felt like, you know, I got that click. Like, I was an alcoholic. It worked for me. Like, I got what I wanted. I took what I wanted, and nothing stopped me. So that just progressed. It got worse and worse and worse. So, anyways, I got here. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a major alcoholic. And all I think about, you know, is alcohol. And, you know, my life had gotten really sad. I'd walk those 60 blocks here back to my apartment. I lived right down the street on 61st Street, and I worked right down the street on 61st and Madison. And I walked 60 blocks home. These guys that I thought were my friends left me, you know, at this bar. I had spent my last, like, money. I had no money. You know, I was totally broke. And I'd spent everything on alcohol. And I was just saying to myself, not again, not again. You know, it was like, spent all my money. I had fair-weather friends. No one cared about me. I didn't care about myself. The lowest self-esteem ever. I was so scared of walking into this room and looking at you guys. And you know, because I thought if I looked at you in this lineup of people, like, saying hello to me and trying to, like, make me feel comfortable, I thought you'd know, you know, how full of baloney I was and, like, how screwed up I was. And, You know, so many amazing things have happened in the past 4+ years, and I can't even, you know, imagine just like 4.5 years ago what's happened. You know, I've gotten my life back. Like, I never had my life. You know, I was always a class clown. I always was kicked out of school. You know, I show up on time. I made so many excuses while I was drinking. I was always late. I always had like 5 hours of sleep. My eyes were burning, you know, just hungover, sick, spent too much money, couldn't be trusted, stealing, lying, cheat. You know, all these great things that you do while you're an alcoholic, I had them. And I had just horrible self-esteem. So, you know, this program, you know, I just can't even imagine. I was telling Michael before the meeting, you know, when I first got sober, my second meeting was Madison 73. And Michael used to chair that meeting, and, you know, I'd go to that, and I'd, like, put a baseball hat on and, like, a hooded sweatshirt and pull it over my head, and I didn't want anybody to see me because I was so miserable. And it took me a while. I was one of those guys that were, like, sicker than others. And unfortunately, I've only got, like, a minute left. So life is so good. I never knew it would be this good. You know, as like a little kid, like all my dreams, like all the stuff I ever, you know, I'm not talking about like the external stuff. Like, I got like great stuff that's happened to me in my life, but the feeling I have being able to sit on my couch, being alone, comfortable, reading a book, or being able to show up on time or not worry about what I did yesterday, the ability to just live life on life's terms and be a gentleman, not steal something and not lie about the situation. It's just, and show up for someone else and not want something in return. You know, these are things that, like, I got in sobriety. And just the feeling is extraordinary. I can't even put it to words right now. But thank you very much for having me speak. And that's it.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Natalie.
Wow, it's a lot of eyes staring back at me. Hi, my name is Natalie. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is August 12th, 2004, and my sponsor is Thea. I'd like to thank Thea for asking me to speak, and thank my husband, who is here to support me, and my sponsees, Allison and Elaine, for being here. Where do I start? You know, the only thing I can really say is that this program has given me freedom. Freedom from my mind, freedom from the emotional baggage that I spent 10 years, that I spent 10 years building up and dragging along with me. I like to compare my sobriety to like an onion. I started out drinking at 14, but in high school I really didn't. I was kind of like the nerdy valedictorian straight A person who stood out on the fringes of the popular crowd. So I always wanted to be part of the popular crowd, but I never quite got there. But, you know, when I did drink, I had elements of being part of it because I would use it to grease my social anxiety, I guess. And it helped me talk to people. So that's really why I started. But when I went to college, you know, I was like a number and I loved it. I didn't actually want to be in high school, I guess I kind of wanted to be the center of attention. But when I went to college, I really didn't. And so and that's really when my drinking took off. I was partying Tuesday through Saturday, 5 nights a week. I don't know how I was able to maintain, you know, a pretty good grade point average, but I did. And that was always like my justification that I did not have a drinking problem. The first time that I had a moment of clarity that I might have a drinking problem was actually at 19. So at this point, I'd only been drinking 5 nights a week for about a year. And you know, in my history of drinking, I had about 4 or 5 of those moments of clarity, and I always attribute that to my higher power, like knocking on the door, saying, "Natalie, come on, hi, I'm here." I went to church as a kid, but when I went to college, it was like, I'm done with you. I'll see you in about 10 years. And that timing is kind of correct. Cause that's when I quit drinking. So, you know, But just to give you some things of why I thought I had a problem, that when I would go out, there was never let's go get a drink. Well, there was never a concept of one drink. It was always like three, five, usually more. When I was hungover, I just remember like these headaches and that guilt and feeling that and not knowing what to do with it. Having that anxiety about why I didn't remember the night before. And if I just had one or two memories from the night, then I didn't have a drinking problem. The phenomenon of craving. I would have one and, you know, I was constantly wanting a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, and so on. So, I would say in college that that was probably more along the lines of, I really spent a lot of time just drinking a lot and partying, but it was really, once I started working and, while I was going out less during the week, it was really the emotions that brought me to my knees, because I never dealt with the guilt that I felt. And I never, and the guilt that I felt was really caused me to shut down. So the last 3.5 years of my drinking, I was completely shut down. And that's really no way to live, because that's just utter misery. I was miserable. I just remember trying to feel something. I never felt an emotion for like 4 years. And that's just and when I talk about the freedom that this program has given me, it's because I have those emotions back. I can stand up here and cry and be fine, and I can stand up here and laugh with you and be fine. I can take my guilt with me and one day and it's gone the next. I don't have to worry about what I did the night before. I don't have to worry about feeling guilty about something that I said or something that I did, or worrying about if I was at a work happy hour and, you know, seeing if I said something stupid to the point where I would the next day at work, question a lot of people and like kind of gauge people and see like if something happened that was weird. Cause you know, I couldn't remember. Thank you. So I walked into these doors just a completely miserable, shut down person. And I'll just add that, in that I got married about 7 or 8 months before I stopped drinking. So the fact that my husband stuck with me is amazing. But this program has really just given me a freedom. I said that I look at my sobriety as an onion. I spent 10 years closing up and trying to shrink to the point where nobody would pay attention to me. I didn't want to be the center of attention because I wanted to drink and just do it by myself and hopefully, you know, there would be no consequences. But this program, as soon as I walked in and I started doing the step work immediately, and that's the template for freedom. It works. If you walk in and you start these steps immediately and you are miserable, start the steps. And if that's the only part of the program that you take with as much passion that you can muster, then do that part, because that is going to give you the freedom. You know, I just echo what John said. I walked in here and I used to be mad as soon as I got here, in immediate resentment, because all you people were happy. I used to call you the AA cheerleaders, and I was just like, are you kidding me? I would just be so irritable when I walked out of here, but now I'm standing up here, so I'm eating my words. And that's okay. I'm happy about that. So, you know, the steps, it's in the book. So, you know, to the newcomer, if you are here and you're not sure that you should be here, hopefully you've heard some things that you can relate to. That, you know, the decision really has to be up to you, but I can tell you that if you start doing these steps and work with a sponsor, first of all, you have to get one. So if you don't have one, get a sponsor. If you don't have one, talk to me. I'll be your sponsor. And we can start working the steps. Because that is really the freedom. How I've gotten my freedom. That is really what I attribute to how good I feel today and how happy I am. The fact that I can have a natural smile on my face, being up here and actually laugh genuinely is something that's, I still am so amazed at, because I didn't do that for the last 3.5 years of my drinking. I think with, you know, starting off with I've always been told, you know, first 3 steps are trying to find your higher power and reconnecting with that. My experience has been that this was the only way that I could reconnect with my higher power, because for so long I felt so stupid praying, or I felt so silly, like that mind, that voice in my head was always like, Natalie, what are you doing? That's the alcoholic mind. That's like your worst enemy. You should always do the exact opposite of what it tells you. That's why we have sponsors, so we can, you know, check ourselves. But this program, the first 3 steps really reconnected me to my higher power. Four through 6 or 7, I think it is, really gets you, is the way that I was able to release all of my baggage that I carried around with me. And that's really given me the freedom, to be okay with letting that go, and to be okay with not forgetting it, because I don't ever want to forget it, because if I do forget it, then I'm 1 step closer to a drink. But I can keep it in the past and let it be, and I can look forward to the future. I have so many wonderful blessings in my life. I live in a fantastic city, the best city in the world. I used to think my life started at night. Now it starts during the day, on the weekend. You know, I notice like how beautiful the sky is in the morning. And, that may sound a little bit silly, but those are the little things that I overlooked, you know, when I was drinking, and now that I realize. So, I think I'm about out of time, but thank you very much for letting me speak.
Bulletin board. Our main speaker tonight is Chris S.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, what a great crowd. This is a great meeting. I'd like to thank Vince for asking me to come up here. On or around December 28th, 1989, the grace of God separated me from alcohol for the last time, and for that I'm very, very grateful. The things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and was willing to participate in helped me to stay in fit spiritual condition so that my higher power could work in and through me and keep me separated from alcohol. And I am very, very grateful for that. My home group is the Spiritual Awakenings Group in Burnsville, New Jersey. I'm very active in AA. As a matter of fact, this meeting is about at least 1 hour and 10 minutes away from my house. And when I walked in tonight, I knew about 20 people. So I've been around for a while, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably every single positive thing that's going on in my life today is a direct result of what Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me. I want to start with one of the earliest manifestations of what I believe was my alcoholism. And that took place the day my mother told me that I have to get in the car. She's taking me off to kindergarten. Now, I hadn't gotten out a lot much on my own by this time, so this is a little bit of a traumatic thing for me. And it was so long ago that it was actually a Packard automobile. I don't know if anybody remembers the Packards. But she put me in the car and she drove me into town to the kindergarten place. And I remember her pulling up in the driveway, letting me out, saying, "There's the building," and taking off. And I'm standing on the top of this hill looking down, and what I saw was a bunch of kids just having a blast. They're playing kickball and tag. Looked like they'd been friends for 100 years. I felt like an idiot. I was standing there like, I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, you know, what if I don't fit in? You know, what if they make fun of me? What if I get ostracized? And I had this sense of self-centered fear that just came over me. And at that point in time, I could have used a couple of shots. You know what I mean? Because That is exactly what I needed, standing there looking down at this kindergarten class, because my problem for the next 7 or 8 years was that I didn't have any alcohol. From that moment forward, I had to act as if everything was okay inside me, to act as if I wasn't afraid or anxious or resentful or whatever my emotional state would be at that time. My first drink, I'm about 12 or 13 years old, and I'm hanging out with a couple of guys, and I thought it would be cool to cut school, go back to my mother's house, and get drunk. You know, I knew there was like a liquor closet there. Now, I don't come from an alcoholic family. I had to blow the dust off of this bottle. So there wasn't a lot of drinking. You know, I feel for you if you come from one of those hellacious alcoholic families. But, you know, I came from a little Cape Cod house, a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, you know, cats. I mean, wasn't a big deal. There was never like a harsh word. I was the dysfunction in that family, let me tell you. But anyway, we decide to go back to my house, and I bring down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. And I don't know anything about drinking. I'm 12, right? But I've seen the John Wayne movies. You know how he busts through the saloon doors and he goes, "Bartender, whiskey!" And the bartender takes a bottle of whiskey and fills up a couple of water glasses or a water glass and hands it to John, and John pounds the water glass down, grabs the bottle, and goes back to the table. So I start pouring out this warm Four Roses whiskey into water glasses and handing it out to my friends. Now, let me tell you what my friends did, and then I'll tell you what I did. My friends had about 2/3 of the glass, and they were good. You ever drink with people like that? I'm good. I'm fine. Go, you know, I'm going home now. What? You know, I live in New Jersey, so it was always like, let's go to the city. You know, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. You got to work the next day. So, you know, I never got along with those people who had enough, you know, I'm just going to have two. So anyway, they just had like 2/3 of this glass and they were fine. And then they watched the show. Okay. I drank 3 glasses of this stuff and whatever they had left, and I went into a blackout, my first blackout. Anybody in here familiar with blackouts? They're unnerving, aren't they? Especially like when you travel, you know, wake up in Topeka with one shoe or something, you know? Then you have to act like you really want to be there, you know? Because you can't look stupid. But anyway, so I go into a blackout, I trash the house, and I have a hangover. One of those hangovers where you have to stay horizontal for about 2 days, you know what I mean? Just horrible feeling. And if I'd have drank or ate anything besides alcohol and felt that bad, I never would have gone near it again. I would have had an adequate mental defense against it. The problem was that scared kindergartner I was talking to you about, when I hit drink number 2, he disappeared. All of a sudden, I felt larger than life. All of a sudden, I was like the coolest guy. That self-centered fear was gone. And I was funny, and I was cool, and I didn't care what you thought of me. And there was all this freedom that I got from the alcohol. So I started to slowly forget how bad it made me feel, and I started to remember what it did for me. It was the anti-Chris elixir that I'd been looking for my whole life. It was something that would let me actually step out and feel okay about it, you know, and not have all this repressed anxiety. So I started drinking. I wasn't going to ever drink Four Roses again, please. Yeah. But I started to figure out how to drink it. The drinking age was 21 at that time, and I was 13, so it was problematic, but nothing an alcoholic can't overcome. So I started to figure out, you know, where was I going to buy it? Where was I going to drink it? You know, all this stuff. And I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. Now, I come from a really smart family. My brother and sister are both Phi Beta Kappa PhD professors. My mother and father were, you know, top in their class and educators. And I graduated high school second stupidest kid in my class. They used to say, "Chris, you've got so much potential." You know, you ever hear that? Yeah. I wish I could have bottled the potential I had. I would have been all right. But anyway, you know, I started to take Wednesdays off to break up the week, you know, things like that, you know. And, you know, where's Chris? Oh, it's Wednesday. Oh, yeah, it's Wednesday. It's his day off. I mean, I didn't, I became preoccupied with alcohol. And anything that was going to get in the way of my drinking, you know, had to go. So you know, here I am. I'm terrible grades, like D minus minus grades. And, you know, I never thought to myself, like, what was happening was I was getting I never said to myself, wow, Chris, you know, you're getting preoccupied with alcohol. You should take a look at that, because if you keep on this way, you may not get into the college of your choice. I didn't think that. You know what I thought? Who cares is what I thought. That's like the rallying war cry of the active alcoholic. Who cares? So anyway, I get out of high school, just barely get out of it, and I took a year off. You know, it was all too much for me, I guess, at that time. You know, I had to like take a year off. And I told one person one time that it was to find myself. He goes, "You weren't looking for anything, especially yourself." So I took a year off, and slowly I started to realize a lot of my friends are going to college. They're like getting jobs. They're growing up. And I just loved the high school parties. You remember the high school parties where when alcohol was working, if it was working for any of you? I mean, it was working for me for a while. I mean, I felt great, and I'd have a couple of drinks before I got to the party, and then the music would be loud, there'd be dancing, and there'd be a fight, you know, you'd molest the women and they'd be okay with it, you know. I mean, you know, it was just a great time. And everybody's gone, you know, the high school is over, and I'm still like looking for that party, for that feeling. And it's, everybody's gone. It got to the point where the people I had to hang out with to continue on, they didn't even have real names. They were like Weezer and Green Man. You know, those are people I ended up partying with at the end. So, the milkman could have seen that I was on a decline. You know, that my drinking was just wiping me out. But I kept thinking I had everything under control. Well, I hooked up with a marvelous codependent somewhere along the way. I you know, after high school, she thought of me as much as I did, you know, so it worked out great. And you know, she'd pick up all the pieces, you know, after a car crash. She'd go, like, you know, get the car out of impound and all those things that you need done, and bail money and all that. And we ended up setting up house. I moved down to Florida because a friend of mine said, "Chris, you got to get down here, man. You wouldn't believe the parties down here." So I went down there. And I am not a paragon of maturity at this point in time, right? I had absolutely no business being with this person. We ended up getting married, and because she was Catholic, 9 months to the nanosecond later, my daughter was born. And it could have set your watch to it. So all of a sudden, I've got this family, and I'm like, you know, she wanted me to put insurance on the car and, you know, come home at night and, you know, stop spending the weekend with Weezer and Green Man and all this stuff. It's just unreasonable. You know, get a job. I mean, get off my back. You know, I mean, I just couldn't deal. So that didn't last. I mean, I couldn't offer what a family needed. I was, you know, way too into the booze and way too immature. So she left me, and now I'm really drinking because she left me when I needed her most. You know? I mean, is that a great excuse? So I'm shacked up with a couple of, one guy's a Quaalude salesman, you know. Another guy's been on unemployment for like 4 years. These are like my roommates. And I'm just drinking. I'm out of my mind drinking. I'm crashing cars. I'm getting DWIs. I'm waking up in jail wondering why I'm there. And I found out that you don't wake up your bunkmate and ask them. They get upset. You know, so I learned a lot in my, and never ever say keep in touch to the people that you meet in jail. Oh, that was a hard lesson to learn. Anyway, so, you know, she leaves me, and it got to the point where the world was falling in on me. The cops were looking for me. I hadn't done my community service. I hospital bills, ambulance bills. I decide, what are you going to do? I decide, my mother needs a little help around the house back home. You know, I think I'll move back and give my mother some help back at the house, because that's what a macho guy does when you got nothing left to do. So I moved back home with mom for 8 years. And I was like, the last 8 years of my drinking, God bless her. I'm still making amends. But I'm back in town, and somewhere along the line, I become an electrician. You know, I don't know how that happened, because I was not a good one. I was a bad electrician. I would blow things up, and I'd drill into your closet and pull your good suits through the ceiling. I mean, now, this one time, I'm drilling a hole for new computer cash registers come around. So I'm drilling a hole in the floor with this big drill with a big auger bit, and it had a locking trigger, and I'm not paying attention because it's the lingerie section of this department store. So I'm preoccupied. And the thing gets away from me, so I bear down on it, and I accidentally lock the trigger. And it spins me around a circle and ties me up in the cord, and the auger bit rips the pants off my ass. So all of a sudden, finally it unplugs from the wall, and I'm tied up to this drill with no pants and in the lingerie section, and everybody's looking at me. And you got to be cool, right? You know, so I'm like, oh, yeah, things always get away from me like this. I'm like a really bad electrician. Terrible things are happening. This one day, I come in and I'm so hungover, I can't put the ground screw in the outlet box. And this is how good I'm 33 at this time, okay? This is my career. I'm 33, and the boss put a 19-year-old kid in charge of me. Yeah. That's how much faith he had in me. So I'm sitting there trying to get this screw in the outlet box, and the 19-year-old kid's looking at me like, you pathetic, no good, no account, you know, because I can tell what he's thinking. You know, when you're an alcoholic, you can hear people thinking at you. So I knew right away what this guy was thinking, and I just couldn't take it. I mean, I'd lost a family. I had 3 DWIs. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I mean, you know, lost all my friends. I mean, even Weezer and Green Man weren't talking to me anymore. So what did it take? It took not being able to put this screw in an outlet box for me to finally say, I've had enough. And I signed myself into a rehab. You know, I remember got really drunk, you know, get up the courage to make the call. I call them up. I go, I'm coming in. They're like, well, who are you, first of all? You know, and so anyway, I go into this place, and I did the 28 days, and I got the $13,000 big book and the pat on the butt to AA, and off I went to AA. Now, I didn't understand the first step. I really didn't. I thought the first step was, I need to remember not to drink. I need to remember not to drink. That's what I need to do. So if I go to a couple of AA meetings every week, that'll remind me not to drink. Well, I didn't have a clue what the first step was. I was going to 2 AA meetings and 2 outpatient meetings, and I gotta tell you, I wanted to stay away from booze as much as anybody ever wanted to stay away from booze. I had a desire to not drink anymore. Let me tell you, it was killing me. I wasn't even pushed into the rehab. I voluntarily went in because I knew I needed help. I voluntarily went to outpatient and paid $35 a night to hear some muttonhead talk about their personal problems, you know, and hopefully get something out of it. And on this went. I'm going to AA meetings. It's like castor oil treatment to me. You know, going to an AA meeting was just really tough. It was not fun for me. That's how much I wanted to stay separated from alcohol. Now, on the way to an AA meeting one day, the thought crosses my mind. I haven't been drunk in almost 90 days. I hardly can remember what it's like to be drunk. And, you know, I'm not really doing a lot in the AA. That, you know, they've got some other suggestions, and I don't really. I bet you if I bought a gallon of vodka, took it home and drank it, I'd do AA better. So I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it to improve my sobriety. Imagine running that one by your sponsor. I mean, and of course I didn't have one. So 6 months later, Christmas at the Schroeders. Okay, this is 1989. My mother's there, brother, sister, nieces, nephews, cats, the whole deal. They're all there for Christmas, and I start drinking, and I go into a violent blackout where I threaten all their lives. It's Christmas. I'm gonna kill all of you. I'm gonna kill every one of you. That really wasn't the festive type of spirit everybody was looking for. So they picked up their Christmas and they took it elsewhere, thank you. I come out of this blackout. It's like a multi-day blackout. I come out of it and I'm shaking, and I go in the kitchen and there's a pile of vodka bottles in the sink like this. I don't even remember buying them. Must have been some sight, because I used to buy one bottle at a time because I might quit. You ever do that when you're smoking? You buy like one pack at a time because you might quit tomorrow. So it must have been a sight just going back and forth uptown getting the vodka. Anyway, I start to go into the DTs. Anybody in here ever have the DTs? It's, you know what I'm talking about. It's not pretty. There was animals running around the room, and there was things scratching on the side of the house to try to get in, and the slip covers had maggots and bugs all over it, you know, and I'm laying there and a demon comes out of the ceiling. I mean, you know, really, really great stuff. And I remember when I saw the demon, I just screamed out, "God help me!" like that. And it was the first humble asking from God for anything that I think I can remember. And I really meant it, because I was absolutely desperate. I haven't had a drink since then. Now, after I finally got to the point where I could get out, I knew I needed to get to an AA meeting. Had to get back to AA. But the car I had at that time was a 1976 Ford Granada with no clutch, no parking brake, no heater core, no muffler. I was busy. You know, I didn't have time really to fix this thing. You know how we are. So because there's no clutch, I have to find a meeting that's flat. So I'm looking a book, and I've got to find a Sunday night meeting that's flat. I find this meeting in Morristown, New Jersey, and I get there. And this car is just a piece of crap, you know, one of those Quaalude cars. Anyway, I come pulling up, and there's a church, you know, similar to this, and there's all kinds of steps outside, and a million of my peers are outside having a cigarette. Now, I have to pull in, and I have to go up the hill a little bit to get into the parking lot. There's no clutch, right? No muffler. So I've got to gun this thing to get up this tiny little incline. So I got to go, blah! Just to go like up 4 feet. And you can see the people like standing there on the stairs like, "Look at me. Must be a new guy," you know? And I had to go park the car against a tree because it had no parking brake, and I was afraid it'd roll away while I was in the meeting. So anyway, I'm in the meeting. I'm in the meeting now. I'm terror stricken from this detox. You know, I mean, I'm shattered, and I sit down, and I don't realize it, but it's a step meeting, and everybody's reading a paragraph out of the step book, and they're coming down the aisle at me, right? I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't even hold the book, let alone read a paragraph." So what do? I got the hell out of there. I went outside, and I'm standing on the steps, and I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm thinking to myself, am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to do AA? Am I going to be able to stay here? Because I know if I don't stay here, I'm going to die. Do I have to go die? Is there going to be a way to stay? I mean, it was one of those real pivotal moments for me. And this guy, I'll never forget, this guy named Jorge comes out, and he starts asking me some questions like, "What's going on with you?" And I'm like, "Relapses, demons, just terrible." And he goes, "Well, I'll tell you what. Well, come on back into the meeting with me, and, you know, tomorrow, there's this meeting tomorrow in my hometown, and I was going to go to this meeting." And he knew what tomorrow meant. You know what tomorrow means. He knew what tomorrow meant. So he insisted. He said, "No, you're coming back into the meeting." And he drags me back in. He sits me down in the second row. And by now, the sharing had started, and people are raising their hands and sharing. And he looks at me, and he goes, "Now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." And I'm like, "Well, tomorrow, there's this meeting tomorrow where everybody introduces himself as new." He goes, "Raise your hand and tell him." He's starting to get loud now, so people are looking at me. And you know what happens after they start looking at you? It's not just a minute later they're going to be thinking at you. So I got to do something. So I shoot my hand up right in the middle of somebody sharing. And, you know, the person in the front's a little confused, but, you know, cuts the person off. And shuts the person up, and then calls on me. And I said something like this: "Oh, it's Chris, I'm going out there drinking, there's a relapse, it's a demon, it's just terrible, thank you." And everything's quiet for a minute, and then all of a sudden it was, "Yay!" They all start cheering, you know? I'm thinking, my God, this is the lowest point in my life, and everybody's like happy for me, and they're smiling, you know, and I can just, "And you made, I had problems until I listened to you." You know, I could hear him So anyway, I got myself a sponsor. I got myself a home group. I did what they asked me to do because the other things were just, you know, I couldn't even imagine going on the way I was going on. So I got myself a sponsor, and I started to get really active in AA. I mean, really active. I was doing maybe 14 meetings a week. I was a secretary over here. I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting over there. You know, and I was doing everything you could do. I was a coffee maker, sometimes the tugboats with the most steam pull the boats. So I was slowly giving good share, you know, so people were like asking me to sponsor them. So I'm getting really active, but that scared little kindergartner is still inside me. The emotional unmanageability is still on me. I still get really resentful. I still have a lot of self-centered fear. I've got guilt and remorse out the wazoo. All this stuff. I'm just burdened with self. You know what I mean? But I'm doing everything in AA. So I'm sober, but I'm not recovered. And this guy, Radio Shack Mike, we used to nickname everybody back then. Radio Shack Mike gave me a bunch of tapes. This one time he gave me some Louise Hay tape, affirmation tapes, where you're supposed to plug it in and say to yourself in front of a mirror, "Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy." And you're supposed to do it until you believe it. Like, I remember breaking the tape in half. I mean, like, I'm an insane alcoholic. Trying to treat my alcoholism with an affirmation tape is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? So I don't trust him, but he comes back to me. He comes back to me with these tapes, and he goes, "You're hardcore, man. You might like these guys." I go, "Who are they?" He goes, "A couple of guys, Joe and Charlie from Arkansas." I'm like, "Arkansas? Arkansas? I'm from the Northeast. We do more thinking before 9 o'clock than an Arkansasian does all day. But what are you going to tell me?" You know, but I have a long ride to work. Okay, so I've got some time. So I start plugging these tapes in. And here's what they told me. They said, "Chris, you don't have a program. Everything you're doing is fellowship. You're fellowshipping out the gazoo, but you don't have a program. And if you don't get a program and you're alcoholic, you're going to die." So I've got my first big resentment in AA, you know, listening to these tapes. I put them off to the side like, you know, what do they know? But I'll tell you what, there's a place in the big book that talks about, if we've disturbed you about your alcoholism, this is all to the good. And that's what Joe and Charlie did. They disturbed me about my alcoholism. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I didn't have a program. The steps, absolutely. This is a 12-step program. This is not a meeting program. It's a 12-step program. So somewhere about 6 months later, I take these tapes out. Because in my area, in 1989 and 1990, there weren't a lot of big book meetings. There weren't a lot of big book workshops. There weren't a lot of sponsors that would take you over to their house and take you through the big book. That wasn't what they did back then. So I remember listening to these tapes and opening up the big book, and to the best of my ability, doing the resentment inventory and the fear inventory and the harms to others inventory. And then I got together a list of people that I had harmed, and I went out and, to the best of my ability, made direct amends to those people. And I actually started to work a program, and I started to feel a lot better. I mean, incredibly. You know, that bondage itself started to dissipate. Now, I had been sponsoring a number of people, and they were drinking on me. You ever have sponsees drink on you, make you look bad? Well, I didn't want to deal with that, so I started bringing them over to my house and doing what I did with this, you know, opening up the big book and going through the big book with these guys. And I found out something very significant. The people who went through the process with me, not only did they get sober, but they're all still around. They're all card-carrying AA members in good standing, and their quality of life is out of the atmosphere. You know, they're amazing things are happening to them. Am I grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous? I got to tell you, there's nothing I'm more grateful for. You know, I was a bad electrician when I first got sober. I've worked my way up to managing a pretty big piece of business. I've got like 60 employees. Let me tell you, you wouldn't put me in charge of a lemonade stand, you know, when I was new. So things are going great there. I ended up meeting a wonderful woman in recovery. You know, boy meets girl on AA campus and trouble soon follows. Met, you know, absolute wonder, you know, we've been married 11 years now, and that's just absolutely amazing. And she sponsors a million women, and I, you know, you come over to our house and somebody's going through the steps or somebody's in crisis or the phone's ringing. I mean, we have a real recovery house, you know, and some of the people who've been over there say it's just a safe, wonderful, comforting place. And, that's the exact opposite of wanting to kill everybody over Christmas, you know. I mean, if you're, you know, there's a lot of people who've raised their hand with under 90 days. There's two things that's absolutely true in your case that you don't believe right now. One of them is you're in much more trouble than you think you are. If you're under 90 days, you are minimizing like a sumbitch. Okay? Alcoholism is much worse than you're giving it credit for. The second truth is there's more answers in Alcoholics Anonymous than you believe there are. There are answers in Alcoholics Anonymous for practically everything. As I started working the steps and as I started to recover, I started to be able to deal with other things in my life, with the other things that I thought were separate from my alcoholism. You know, so if you are new and you're coming back and, you know, it seems like life is dealing you a rotten hand, you know, let me tell you, positive actions result in positive results. And that's really what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's spiritual living 101. So, I encourage everybody that's in here, under 90 days to stay. It's not okay to leave Alcoholics Anonymous and go out there and have alcoholism, trash your life again. It's not okay. It's much better to stay in here. Find yourself a sponsor who's experienced with the steps and then become of service. Find ways to become of service. This group is just unbelievable with the service. I wish my group was half as involved with service commitments and things like this. I want to thank Vince for asking me to come in tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor to speak at your group, and God bless all of you.